friends. Welcome to Silo Busting. I'm your host, Mo Banjoko, a senior manager in the financial services consulting practice at EPAM. According to the World Bank's Global FinDex Database report of 2021, about 1.4 billion adults remain unbanked. Further escalating things, the COVID pandemic drove a large increase in digital payments as cash and in-person interactions were restricted. Leora Clapper, lead economist in development economics at the World Bank and main author of the report, says that reaching the unbanked population will require governments and private sector to work hand in hand to forge the policies and practices needed to build trust in financial services providers, confidence in using financial products, new tailored product designs, as well as a strong and enforceable consumer protection framework. Are the unbanked a priority customer segment for banks that claim to have financial inclusion as part of their core missions? No, says Brianna Marbury, CEO at Interledger Foundation. Banks use rhetoric around addressing and closing the financial inclusion gap as part of their PR campaigns, as the underlying infrastructure needed to truly be inclusive are yet to be enhanced to make them more accessible and cheaper to use. A major goal of her work at Interledger is to help drive financial inclusion on a global scale. For example, our society still allows for payday lending, which impacts the most vulnerable in our communities and has a tendency to lock them into a perpetual cycle of debt that they cannot break out of. Also, fees to move money from developed to developing countries are high and options are limited. Being underbanked means that one does not have equitable access to financial services. The issue of physical bank branches closing, especially in rural and poor areas, also exacerbates the accessibility issue. Lack of broadband access, expensive internet access, and minimal banking products designed for the less affluent also need to be addressed. Investments in digital technology to connect the underserved communities are a must. We cannot truly move ahead as a society if we leave some people behind. Let's have a listen.
Thanks, Brianna, for joining us. So today, as we had planned, we're going to be talking about financial inclusion, and which is a topic that I've heard for a long time sitting at banks' board meetings when people bring up the requirements from a community impact or a desire to help the community, or sometimes really just because they want to show the brand differently. So sometimes they're good reasons, sometimes they're not so great reasons, but this is something that we discuss in banking on a regular basis. And a lot of times, as I just mentioned, we're really just doing it for PR, but you and your organization are actually doing it for real, which is why I wanted to talk to you about it.
What an intro, Alex. Okay.
So, you know, before we get into the discussion of financial inclusion, you know, looking at your background, I want to understand how you went from being an accountant at HP to being the CEO of a global non-for-profit. How did that work? What was the journey like?
I want to understand it too, Alex. It's really, really confusing. But no, really, when I started at Hewlett-Packard, I just felt that I needed something more and I wanted to make a difference. And so I went back to school, got my MBA. And right when I was about to finish my MBA, I said, I really want to work for organizations where I feel like I'm making a difference. So I went to work for the Jack King Cook Foundation, and I was never just, I don't want to say typical accountant because I don't want to generalize all accountants, but I really enjoyed talking to people. And so the executive director back then, he saw something in me that I didn't see at the time and said, you know, I can really see you running an organization one day. And I was like, what? Like that was just something that blew my mind because it was early on in my career and it wasn't something that I was thinking about. But he started mentoring me and introducing me to different people. As I left the Jack King Cook Foundation, I took different management courses, and it was a lot of preparation and some luck involved in there as well. So that's how I'm here. And I just so happened to, as things work in, you know, a lot of different areas, it was a friend of a friend who was doing recruiting and said, "Hey, I heard about this position. I think you could be perfect for it." And I didn't know anything about the payments space, even though I was an accountant. People kind of conflate the two. And so I knew all about foundations and nonprofits and operations, but I didn't know anything about payments. So I had to learn that side of it when I came onto the foundation.
So let's dive into financial inclusion. What does financial inclusion mean?
Well, it means accessible and equitable access to not only like everyday essentials such as accounts, but other financial services that banks offer, such as access to credit, housing loans, and historically underserved groups such as low-income people, women, are most affected by being excluded by these traditional financial systems such as banks. So in some cases, it was done purposely, and in poor areas, banks didn't find them worthy enough to build the infrastructure needed to service these populations because they weren't considered a good return on investment.
Right.
They didn't hold large amounts of money in the bank. They couldn't meet the minimum balance requirements. In some cases, they didn't have IDs because that was not something that was culturally a norm for them. Mm-hmm. And they did this. They just decided not to go in those areas instead of finding alternative ways to service people. So
why should banks be looking at financial inclusion as something that they should be pursuing beyond just, you know, PR?
Well, what ended up happening is that because, you know, banks are all about the bottom line, and they didn't go into these areas because it didn't make sense for them with the bottom line. But as people do, they found a workaround. And so there was the invention of mobile money, and it allowed people to move money between peers. And so even though these people didn't have a lot of in their balance overall, the aggregate amount of their transactions equal to trillions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And so now you see banks trying to capture that, and you have to see me doing air quotes, emerging market, because they're trying to now capture these funds of these people that they ignored for so long.
Right. And so according to the World Bank, globally, there are 1.4 billion adults that don't have access to banking. So what does that mean? What, you know, how big of a challenge is that?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. If your goal is to get people to have accounts at banks, at traditional banking areas, that could be pretty hard depending on where they are. Some people might not have access to the internet. Some people might not have banks in their areas. But if you're looking at it from, let's see how many people we can bring into the financial ecosystem, even though 1.4 billion people are unbanked and a lot of them don't have access to the internet and don't have the infrastructure, one thing they do have are mobile phones. So looking at alternative ways to provide services to people can mean bringing them into the digital financial economy.
Right. And you and I have talked about in the past about M-Pesa, UPI, M-Pesa in Kenya, UPI in India, Alipay in China. Those are payment schemes that have addressed some of that. In your view, is that what we're talking about, or is there a bigger play?
Well, yes. So a lot of those schemes sprung up to fill a gap, right? So they were very important. They were what was needed at the time. They still serve, they're still very useful to people. But and from my view at the foundation, we're trying to expand that view. So M-Pesa, Orange, they're siloed networks, mm-hmm. meaning it's not easy to transact with someone outside of the network.
Right.
So that's hard if you're trying to transfer money to a relative who might live in, say, a country right across the border that doesn't have the particular app that you have. So what we're trying to do is expand the work that's already being done to create interoperability between systems. Mm-hmm. So how do we make it so that transferring money across networks and borders is easy and seamless?
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to expand the view and create more opportunities, more economic opportunities for people to participate in their digital financial world.
Yeah, so remittances is a big challenge for many. And when I moved to the U.S. As a kid, I remember my parents sending money back to Colombia to our family, and it was not an easy process. Mm-hmm. either you paid a hefty fee on both ends to send and to receive, or you would do something like you put a $100 bill in a card, and you mail it, and you hope that it shows up at the other end.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Later on when I went into banking, I thought, well, that was a novel way to do it, and saved a lot because there were plenty of places where you could. Convert the $100 to Colombian pesos, but the problem was always, will the money actually get there? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it didn't.
Yeah,
there was no recourse.
yeah, exactly. And it's so funny because you said that's when you were a kid and when you first moved here, but unfortunately the systems have not improved greatly
exactly.
from that time. I don't know how old you are, but I'm just saying.
No, it's true.
The systems really have not improved since then. Yeah. And so that's one of our goals as well, is to make remittances a lot easier, faster, less expensive. Right now, the currency translation fees lack transparency, how much you're paying. And depending on who you're paying and where you're trying to get that money to, like you said, it's really expensive. So with the protocol, Interledger protocol, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute, we're just trying to make it a lot easier. For instance, there was $60 billion in remittances that went to Mexico last year, and a lot of that was from the U.S. And sometimes they charge fees of up to 20% of what you're sending. So imagine if you were able to, transfer some of those fees into those communities that you're sending money home to, how transformative that would be.
Right. And sometimes in the receiving end, there's no infrastructure, right? And while, let's keep the example of Mexico, while Mexico has a national ID, last time I looked it up, about 50% of Mexicans don't have the national ID because they're not in a situation where they can get that, right? They're in rural areas, unless you're in the big cities, it's not something that everybody gets, even though officially, everyone is supposed to have one. And so how do you open a bank account when you don't have an ID? So there's all kinds of hurdles, just as you said before. But beyond the the unbanked, there's also that other subset of people that are underbanked, yes. Right? That they may have something, but they're not, you know, they're not fully part of the banking system wherever they are. And correct. You know, we see a lot of people in that situation here in the U.S. And you know, we have payday lenders and others that kind of step in to fill the gap, but you know, many times those are not great solutions for people.
Yeah, that's true. Just because you might have a bank account doesn't mean that you use it.
Right.
And that still doesn't mean that you have access to, like you said, credit and loans, and those payday lenders use predatory practices to fill those gaps of people. So being underbanked means that you may have an account, but that doesn't mean you use it, and you still don't have the access, the equitable access to financial services that other people may have.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about Interledger Foundation. Where do you focus, and you know, what's your mission?
So before I talk about the foundation, I will talk about the protocol, the Interledger protocol.
Yep.
And the protocol is a currency agnostic payments network that has the ability to move funds across countries, across the network. And so when we're talking about these issues of being able to transfer money and remittances and the fees from the border, what the protocol aims to do is to, like I said, send money as easy as it is to send an email, basically. It sounds so easy, but it's really, really hard. Mm-hmm. And currency agnostic, meaning that it can be a fiat currency such as USD or pesos. It can also move crypto as well. So if you wanted to do crypto to USD, USD to pesos, whatever you want to do, whatever your goals are, the network just moves the money. And so the foundation was started to be an advocate of the protocol and also hold the trademarks and patents and all of that good stuff, mm-hmm. but also enable people who have been underrepresented and who are usually just consumers of this technology to give entrepreneurs an opportunity to participate in creating their own solutions for their issues. So we give awards and grants to people who are working to build on the network.
So are banks and other financial services organizations using the protocol to get today?
Yes. So we have digital wallets, and we are just now contracting with an emerging bank in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Who are enacting the protocol and implementing the protocol into their systems. We're also in talks with like other government entities who are looking at innovative ways for people to be able to transact within their economies. We know that with COVID, that really increased the amount of digital payments that people made. And so some of the governments have been looking at this as like, how can we make this easier for people? How can we reach people easier in case there's another emergency? And so there's various countries that we're also talking to as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. From a technology standpoint, what are we talking about the protocol? I mean, it interesting to me. I didn't know that you could take crypto and transfer to fiat currency. I thought it was old fiat. But how does that work? I mean, are we talking a blockchain? Are we talking tokens? How does that work?
Yeah. So when the co-creators created the Interledger protocol, they did it based off of the internet. So interledger, mm-hmm. Meaning you can send it to any ledger, any system that has a ledger.
Okay.
We are not a blockchain, although a lot of people think that that is what we are. We do not have a central hub. So it's a peering system. So anyone who's on the network has to have a money transmitter license or have a partner who provides them that money transmitter license.
So you, in some ways, are you competing against the Wises of the world? Or would you want Wise to be part of this?
We, as the Interledger Foundation, we're not competing against anyone because we're a nonprofit. The only thing that we want to do is offer interoperability between systems.
So you would welcome Wise, for example, to be part of the network?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. So what successes have you seen so far in the process, or is it too early to talk about that?
It's early, but so the foundation has only existed for now 3 years. And part of that was kind of learning like what is going on in, you know, the ecosystem, and learning what areas we need to kind of step into and fill the gaps of. So one of our really successful proofs of concepts that we have right now is the pipeline between the U.S. and Mexico. One of our grantees took rural banks in Mexico, as you were talking about, and these rural banks were not connected to anyone but those within their communities.
Right.
So they took the rural banks, connected them to each other, and then from there connected the rural banks to the Central Bank of Mexico. And from the Central Bank of Mexico, we created a connection with a partner in the U.S., and so they were able to transact and send transfer money across the network to Mexico. So that's one of our more exciting proofs of concepts that we have going right now. But we have a lot of different grantees that are doing exciting things. We have people... we've given grants to people in 40 different countries around the world. And in Chile, the peer-to-peer system, PeerPay, where people can transact with each other, because I spent some time down there and I didn't realize that they didn't have anything like a Cash App or a Venmo. And so they're trying to solve for that solution down there. So it's a lot of different exciting projects that we're working on.
Right. It's wild to think that rural banks in Mexico were not connected to each other, right? So the you know, while it sounds like we are talking about international connections, you're actually in some places facilitating the transactions within a country, just as you mentioned Chile. What's the process to be part of the grant? How does one apply for it?
So we have different calls for proposals during the year. And right now we have a financial services call for proposals. So that's where the People's Clearinghouse in Mexico, that's the call that they responded to. And that call happens in three phases. The first one is you're building a plan where you even find out what it takes to become a money transmitter license in your jurisdiction. Because a lot of people they have these great ideas, but they don't know exactly like how much work it takes to get this license in order for you to be in business. So that's the first part. The second part, if you pass on to phase two, is the prototyping stage. So you will build the prototype of what your original plan was. And then finally, in the third phase, you will peer with someone else in the network. So we continuously are doing that throughout the year, and our next call will be open pretty soon. We also have ambassadors because we are trying to reach areas and populations of people that we might not necessarily have connections to. Mm-hmm. So we use ambassadors to spread the word and bring more people into the application process so that it's not just you know, homogeneous, which it was when I first came on board. And so we really want a deep pool of applicants. And if we're talking about solving this issue worldwide, then we need to have other voices in the conversation. So that's our grant programs. We also have an HBCU program, which is at Bowie State University, and we are teaching students about open payments mm-hmm. and the Interledger Protocol. But to get involved,
great.
You can respond to one of our calls.
We've talked mostly about global challenges. What about, you know, domestic challenges here in the U.S.? Do you see your efforts also solving some issues, particularly, you know, for lower income areas, maybe even rural areas, and how they're connected to the banking system?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of people think that the U.S. has no issues with financial inclusion, but and there have been many strides throughout the years to increase financial inclusion, but there's still millions of people in the country who are unbanked and underbanked. And a lot of those communities are within, you know, the lower income communities, rural communities, communities that are minority communities. So, mm-hmm. We are trying to also work with different U.S.-based companies as well to be able to provide, make it easier for people to get payments. So, for instance, I grew up in Detroit, mm-hmm. and I, at one point, was not able to get a bank account myself. Very so, cool. You know, and bank accounts were disappearing from each corner. And bank accounts, banks were disappearing from the corner. And like you said, the, you know, check cashing spots were everywhere. And so you can go in there and pay predatory fees. But now what people have are, you know, Cash App. So what we're trying to do is figure out a way that people can get their cash off of Cash App for those people who can't have accounts. Mm-hmm. So just different solutions for people in lower income areas that, you know, may not be eligible to participate in the traditional financial systems.
So last question. So how can our listeners, which are you know, people in banking, fintech, or technology in general, get involved with the foundation?
Have a conversation with us. Reach out to us. Go to our website, interledger.org. Say, contact us. I love to have conversations with people who are trying to find innovative ways to make payments easier. If you are in banking and you want to update, you know, your outdated system, then we're the answer. We're also holding our annual summit this year in Costa Rica in November. And if people are experts, we're looking for experts in the intersections of payments, tech, and financial inclusion. We'd love to hear from you. And we sponsor people's travel to come out and talk to us about that. So we bring everyone together in the Interledger community to talk about the latest innovations and solutions around this issue that we're trying to solve.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Brianna, for your time. And we'll continue to have this conversation offline.
Thank you so much, Alex. It was a
Thanks.
Pleasure.
This has been Silo Busting, a podcast from EPAM Continuum. EPAM Continuum integrates business, experience, and technology consulting focused on accelerating breakthrough ideas into meaningful impact. Why do we do this? Because real opportunities are inside. Thanks to Brianna Marbury and Alex Jimenez for the great conversation. Cheers to Keith Pilales, a sound engineer extraordinaire, for getting this podcast recorded. Applause to Scott McAllister, our producer, and Ken Gordon, our executive producer, for all their masterminding behind the scenes. I'm your host, Mo Banjoko. Thank you for listening.